The North Sound Energy Week with Stork Technical Services, delivering an unrivaled range of assets, inspect and repair services across the globe.
Hello and welcome to the Energy Week podcast. I'm Rebecca Kern. This week there was an urgent meeting of the Helicopter Safety Steering Group following a dramatic ditching in the North Sea. The Elgin gas leak was finally plugged and Bond flights took to the air after 5 days on the ground. The Helicopter Safety Steering Group, established after the fatal Super Puma helicopter crash in 2009, met in Aberdeen on Monday. It was urgently reconvened following a dramatic helicopter ditching in the North Sea. All 14 men escaped serious injury. On Sunday, the AAIB published the findings of their initial inspection on the aircraft. It revealed there was a 360-degree crack in the main gearbox. I showed Jake Malloy from the RMT Union the report. He gave me this reaction.
Sharp intake of breath, just to, as to how close this flight came to disaster. I mean, a 360-degree crack in the main gearbox, just incredible. Really, really scary. And again, the pilots have got to be commended for their actions and getting everybody out of this thing safely. Just horrifying, absolutely horrifying.
Jake, how surprising is it that this went unnoticed?
Well, the only thing that you can read into the AAIB report, and it's very brief at this moment in time, is that there had been increased vibration and this was being monitored. Only further investigation by AAIB will determine whether or not that's relevant, but that's the one element of the report which stood out for me, that there was already increased vibrations in the main gearbox. And as I say, they were being monitored, but as I say, we'll have to wait for AAIB's full comprehensive analysis of what's going on here.
Now, of course, Bond have issued a statement, a very brief statement this morning, saying that, they maintain their aircraft to the highest levels. And in fact, during the press conference on Thursday evening, I asked the spokesman from Bond, you know, when was the last time this aircraft was maintained? And he assured us all that it was, you know, is maintained every, prior to every single flight. I mean, does it surprise you that was his? Do you believe that?
We've got to take as read what Bond are telling us as regards maintenance, but irrespective of what their maintenance routines are, there's evidence to suggest that there's been a problem with this machine, and there's been a problem in the previous weeks, according to some of the reports that we're getting, emails from passengers and such like. So in order to assure regular flyers we bond, they would suggest that they conduct the same exercise they conducted after the fatal incident in 2009 and review their practices. Look again, just to reassure themselves and everybody using the aircraft that everything is being done in accordance with what they say. And that includes the attitudes and behaviours of the people on site, the safety culture, the whole operation from top to bottom. Because despite what Bond are saying, the evidence that we're seeing and the anecdotal stuff we're hearing suggests the guy's flying, that there's an issue here. So let's put that issue to bed once and for all and do a complete, thorough review.
Now, you mentioned the fatal accident in 2009. Whenever you hear anybody speaking about that accident, it follows with the term catastrophic gearbox failure. I mean, how close do you think we could have been to a repeat of that with this incident, with this crack in the gearbox?
Well, I'm not completely au fait with the technical side of things, but reading the report, a 360-degree crack, that means the entire thing was detached and led to the pumps stopping. We've come pretty close. We've come very, very close indeed. But as I say, the pilots initiated the emergency pump, looking at the report, and took a very rapid decision to put the thing on the water. again, we were even lucky with the weather. You know, had the weather been foul, which it can be, 5-6 metre seas and such like, we could have been looking at a completely different outcome. But no, I mean, I think we should look on the positives and the fact that everybody's at home now with their families. But they've come close. They've come very, very close.
Absolutely. I mean, you mentioned emails from some of the passengers on board, and we saw in some of the local press this weekend that one of the passengers had said they saw oil, you know, running down the wall of the helicopter. I mean, is that something you've heard?
Well, you quite regularly see oil coming down the sides of helicopters. I mean, I worked as a helicopter landing officer for several years offshore, and I've brought to the attention of many flights and pilots the fact that there was oil coming down the side of the aircraft. That can be down to any number of issues. It's too early to say that it was directly apportionate to the gearbox failure. I think we should wait and see what the AIB have to say on that. But oil running down the side of helicopters is not a new phenomenon. It's been around for years.
And just finally, Jake, as we understand it, the steering group is meeting tomorrow. Is that something you're aware of?
Yeah, I sit on the helicopter safety steering group, and I'll be at the meeting tomorrow. But then I'd already initiated a discussion with the group after the alleged engine failure incidents in April. So I was already speaking to the chairman and others in the group prior to Thursday's events. So yeah, it should be an interesting meeting.
Can you remind us who all sits on that meeting, Jake?
All stakeholders. You've got everybody from the CAA, Oil and Gas UK, the contractors, workforce representatives, the helicopter operators, anybody and everybody that has an interest in ensuring the safety of helicopters.
Robert Patterson from Oil and Gas UK spoke to Energy Week after the meeting.
It's quite clear that the Eurocopter of the manufacturers of the helicopter have had to spend some time convincing the European Aviation Safety Agency of whether it is safe to continue flying these helicopters. Following those meetings, which we know took place on Saturday, Eurocopter have issued some further guidance to users of their helicopters. They've lowered the thresholds, the vibration thresholds at which alerts should be made, and following an alert, discussions have to take place with the manufacturer on remedial action. They have also identified there was a problem with a particular batch of rotating shafts. Now, there is only there are only 10 of from this batch, and we've been through a process, or the helicopter operators have been through a process, and they've shown that there are none of this batch in use in the UK other than the one in the helicopter that failed. So we're confident that none of the problem batch exists in any of the UK helicopters. So offshore workers should feel reasonably confident that this sort of thing cannot happen again.
The following day, Bond announced its fleet was fit to fly. The helicopter operator grounded two models following the ditching in the North Sea. Manufacturer Eurocopter have now made certain reassurances, although thanks to a confidentiality agreement, we are not allowed to know what they are. Here's Bond Chief Executive Bill Munro.
As I said 2 days ago, we were waiting for further reassurances from Eurocopter and the regulator in order that we could return to orderly flying. What I can confirm now is that late yesterday afternoon and into early evening, we were having discussions where we received those assurances, so I'm now happy to say that we can return to normal flying.
Now, can you elaborate really on any of those questions you were asking Eurocopter, or indeed any of the answers?
Well, I'm not able to go into the details, because most of that is actually covered under the confidentiality of the AIB investigation, which is ongoing. But what I can say is that we took the additional time in order to get those assurances, putting safety before any commercial considerations, and we're now happy that we're able to go back flying.
Can you give so much reassurances to workers who now will perhaps be up in the air this afternoon?
Well, I think they would be very comforted by the fact that, you know, what we've done is taken the additional time in order to get these reassurances, and I would hope that they would understand why we've done that, considering that you know, we don't take chances with safety. And although it has taken us a little bit longer to get back into operation, I'm sure that they would want us to do the right thing.
Am I right in thinking that this particular shaft that was affected, it was the only one actually in operation in the UK, is that right?
Well, what we understand is that the information on this particular batch is that it is the only one operating in the UK.
So, I mean, can we perhaps say that Bond have been extremely unlucky here?
I think that is very evident, that the part that has actually failed is not maintainable by the helicopter operator, and I think that would be a very clear statement that, you know, that is the only one in the UK, and that it happened to be on a Bond helicopter.
Now, we heard that yesterday after the steering group meeting that I understand the CAA had done an audit of Bond's maintenance systems in the past kind of fortnight before the incident. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, I think what we can say is that we're audited several times a year. The one that we're referencing is the annual audit by the CAA, who's the regulator. It's a very rigorous audit, and as the regulator has announced, there were no findings. So clearly that demonstrates a very high level of confidence in the maintenance procedures and the flight operations procedures that Bond operations have.
Can you elaborate on some of the I understand you're doing the alert system has been changed and the vibration stuff. Can you tell us about those steps that have been taken?
Well, that's been done in accordance with the safety information notice that the manufacturer has issued. And indeed all helicopter operators will have to operate to those criteria. And basically that means that we're closely monitoring the helicopter in order that if there is anything at all, it is highlighted at a very early stage and we revert to the manufacturer. But what I can say is over and above those, Bond has actually undertaken some additional visual inspections on the gearboxes in order that we are satisfied that we can return to service.
And we're hearing from unions this morning, and in fact, many workers have got in touch with us, you know, about their concerns, mm-hmm. and even the two men in particular have decided not to go back offshore. Mm-hmm. I mean, what would you say to those men?
Well, I think, you know, we would understand that people are concerned about the helicopters, given what has happened. But I think with respect to us taking additional time to reassure ourselves that we're happy to go back flying, I think that would be a reassurance to the offshore workforce that we're putting safety before any other commercial pressures, and that we are demonstrating by that fact that we are putting safety first, and therefore I would like to think that provides additional confidence to the workforce.
And just finally, in light of that message there, I mean, do you feel Bond have led the way with safety here? Because CHC and Bristow were criticised for not grounding their Eurocopters.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I can say is that we took the view that we would do these additional checks and we would seek further reassurances before we felt it was appropriate to go back flying. I can't obviously comment on the decisions of the other helicopter operators, but I think what I would repeat is that I would hope that the fact that we've put the safety before commercial considerations would demonstrate to the offshore workforce that we are taking all steps to ensure that we can return service in a safe manner.
I'm sorry, just one more. Do you have a time where your first flight is going back up in the air?
Well, what we're doing at the moment is we're engaging with our clients in order to provide an orderly return to service. That may happen over the next 24 to 48 hours because clearly that can't happen in an instant, and it will depend on the scheduling for the offshore crew changes. But I would imagine it's going to take place over the next 24 to 48 hours.
And any workers listening to this thinking I might be going out this afternoon, tomorrow, whatever, what advice do you have for them? If they have concerns, who do they speak to?
Well, what we will be doing over the next few days is that we will be providing briefings to all the passengers, and we will ask them if they have any concerns. And should there be any questions, we will have people on hand, both flight operations and technical people, in order to provide whatever reassurances individuals require.
The North Sound Energy Week with Stork Technical Services, delivering asset integrity solutions to the global energy industry.
John Taylor from Unite the Union spoke to us following the news about the ongoing fears of offshore workers.
Well, at least for once we've got a consistent view within the aviation industry. I think part of the problem yesterday was that we had different views between experts. And I think that was confusing for the offshore workforce. Unfortunately, you know, we don't know the questions that Bond asked Eurocopter. And by not knowing the questions, nor do we know the answers. And so they're confident that what they're doing is safe. It's a pity that that confidence couldn't be shared with the workforce.
I mean, and their questions and answers we're not going to know about, are we? Because Bill, what's his second name?
Munro
from Bond has just said, you know, told me they're bound by a confidentiality agreement.
Well, that was part of the problem yesterday when, you know, a lot of things we were asking, we kept getting told it was bound by a confidentiality agreement. And if that's what Bond says, then I can't disagree with him. I'm just saying it's a pity. You know, we need to build the confidence of the workforce up that it is safe to fly offshore. You know, people onshore don't know what it's like. You know, you and I have the choice of coming to work by car, bike, bus. The only choice these guys have got is flying in a helicopter.
Now, I've just spoken to a number of workers standing outside Bond, you know, with the perspective of maybe having to fly tomorrow, and a lot of them are very nervous. Can you tell us, you know, if people have been in touch with you, how are they feeling?
Well, we've never had so many phone calls about people showing concern about flying offshore. We did manage to get agreement yesterday that if somebody didn't want to fly, then they didn't have to. If they had concerns about their safety, then they could say, you know, no, I don't want to fly. The problem is there's lots of pressures, isn't there? There's a pressure to pay your mortgage and you know, feed the kids. So I think there'll be a lot of people going offshore, not because they're forced to go off by their employer, but financially forced.
I mean, have you had anyone who outright is refusing to fly? Or I've spoken to another union today who's had word from at least two employees that they actually are thinking about quitting.
Well, we've had one individual who's emailed us who says that he wishes to for us to represent him with his employer about not having to fly in the near future. This is going to have to be an individual thing that we take up with individual members. What we need to do, and I don't think we're close to achieving that yet, is to raise the confidence of the workforce in it's still safe to fly in helicopters offshore.
I understand there's going to be a sort of question and answer with Bond, is that right? Well, or any questions that people have is going to be forwarded on to Bond?
Yes, and the problem with question and answers is that it's bits of paper that are being responded by bits of paper. What we need, and we won't get that until we get the AIB report, is facts. That's what people want, you know? And we've been told that there was a bad contaminated gearbox, and there's 10 of them. There's only one in the UK, but they're not too sure where the other 9 are. Well, let's hope, if they're not too sure, that none of them are in the UK, you know? So, a lot of questions and not enough answers.
As it stands this afternoon, how are you feeling about there being flights? I mean, obviously, CHC and Bristow are continuing to fly anyway, but how are you feeling about the entire fleet going back up?
Well, I'm not an expert. I know nothing about the technicalities of flying a helicopter. We have to listen to what the experts say. As I say, yesterday it was confusing when some experts said it was safe to fly and others say it wasn't. So we have to accept the experts' position and they're saying it's safe and we have to support that, right? But I'm not flying in a helicopter tomorrow. And if I was, I would still have some concerns.
So, I mean, just going back to your point about you've never had so many emails, I mean, that's obviously following the fatal accident in 2009, so it's been even more.
Oh, yeah. There has been more concern shown this time than what was shown the last time.
I mean, why do you think that is? Just because it's, you know, third in 3 years?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons. One of the reasons was that after the last set of accidents, we set up a number of things through the helicopter task force. And one of those was to keep the workforce informed of any incident involving a helicopter, that the crew was supposed to be debriefed, the people flying on a helicopter were supposed to be explained, safety committees were supposed to be discussed, and the wider workforce was supposed to be informed of what was going on. We suddenly find out that that's not happened. There has been a number of incidents that have not been reported. So suddenly, the workforce not only find out about one incident, but they find out about possibly other incidents. Well, that doesn't fill you full of confidence. And one of the things that we've asked for is to relook at all the recommendations that we put forward from the helicopter task force, and let's see if there's other recommendations that's been ignored. We worked very hard with industry to raise the confidence of the workforce a few years ago. It looks like we're going to have to do that again.
I mean, is it a case of broken promises? All these promises made after a major incident and then as it peters out?
Well, my concern is that we were part of those promises. We sat on the committee along with other unions, and I'm extremely upset that it would appear that some of the things that we agreed haven't happened. Now, you shouldn't have to constantly look at what's going on, but it would appear that we're going to have to continue to update how these recommendations are being taken forward.
Are the workers losing faith, do you think?
Well, there's a lot of workers got a lot of concerns. And as I say, if you make a worker a promise and you break that promise, then it's going to be hard to convince them the second time around.
Meanwhile, Alex Salmond paid tribute to the pilots of the helicopter. Mr. Salmond said the Scottish Government had worked with investigations agencies and paid tribute to them and the actions of the pilots.
I'd like to pay tribute to the pilots of the Bond helicopter which ditched last week for their excellent airmanship and quick thinking under these circumstances. The decision to suspend operations of Bond's Super Puma fleet was a matter for the operator pending investigation into the cause of the incident.
The other main energy news this week was after 52 days, the gas leak at the Elgin platform has finally been plugged. It started on March the 25th and led to hundreds of offshore workers being evacuated. A team pumped mud and concrete under the seabed for 12 hours on Tuesday, and the oil giant says it's been a success. Government tests in the water around the Elgin suggest the gas leak hasn't harmed the environment. Environment Secretary Richard Loghead says it's a welcome step in the right direction.
It's very good news that at long last the leak has been stopped and safely. And hopefully the coming work in the next few days will put this issue behind us and the field and the company and the offshore sector can get back to normality as soon as possible.
Total's spokesperson Brian O'Neill says the well kill process isn't yet completed.
Well, the latest is that this morning we've been able to confirm that we have stopped the leak on the G4 well on the Elgin complex. It's not the end of the well kill operation, which started yesterday, but it is a very, very significant milestone in that process. But it doesn't mark the end of the well kill operation. That's still maybe 2 or 3 days away.
There will now be close monitoring of the platform over the coming days, but Total's described the events of the last 24 hours as a major turning point. Alex Salmond jetted to Norway last week to address an international green energy conference in Bergen. As well as renewables, his visit focused on economic opportunities and job creation in the oil and gas and aquaculture industries. During his visit, the First Minister announced oil and gas firm Aker Solutions is creating 500 jobs in Aberdeen. Speaking from the Norwegian capital Oslo, Alex Salmond says it shows the energy sector is still booming.
Exciting developments in the cooperation between Norway and Scotland in oil and gas. I mean, a fantastic company, Global Engineering, Scottish company, GPS, their Norwegian subsidiary, opening up its permanent base near Bergen, an indication of the Scottish skills, Scottish know-how, combined with Norwegian expertise is growing in a growing oil and gas market in Norway. And of course the announcement today of 500 new jobs for Aberdeen by next year from Aker, one of the great Norwegian companies, investing more in its Scottish facilities. It shows you that energy, oil and gas, but right across the energy field is a very much a growing business just now. And we're seeing Scottish jobs, Scottish companies creating jobs in Norway, Norwegian companies creating 500 new jobs in Aberdeen. So good news for Scotland and good news for Norway. Heavy emphasis in our oil and gas strategy on the skills. I mean, you know, what does government do to make sure that we get the benefits from the renewed and powerful forward momentum of the energy markets? Well, you make sure you've got the skills available in your workforce and your people to take advantage of the industrial impact that's going to have. The last thing we want as we move forward in this expansion is to come up against skill shortages, and that's a key provision, and we'll be accenting that in oil and gas strategy, you know, that we can get more and more energy in Scotland, not just fulfilling the 50 years we've got left in the waters around Scotland of oil and gas, but the international marketplace. But we do that by having Scottish skills, Scottish know-how, Scottish expertise. And government with industry has a huge role to play in making sure that happens. I'm seeing the Norwegian Energy Minister this afternoon. I mean, Norway has a great deal to teach Scotland, not so much about the industrial aspects of oil and gas, where Scotland has great expertise and know-how and success, but in terms of husbanding the resource. I mean, Norway's controlled its resources over the last 40 years now, has an investment fund of £300 billion sterling, about £60,000-£70,000 a head for every man, woman and child in this country. Would that we had done the same in Scotland. Would that we now do it over the next 40 years. We certainly should. We absolutely should. And we can look to Norway to see the tremendous success they've made of husbanding their natural resources. We'll also be speaking about the move into renewables, where Scotland is probably ahead of Norway in terms of of the investments we've made, in terms of the licensing we've done. But, you know, where there's a huge scope for Norwegian-Scottish cooperation. So we'll touch on the success of Norway in oil and gas, our present joint ventures in the industry, and also perhaps the cooperation in the renewable future to come.
The company's already one of the biggest employers in the Northeast, with 2,700 staff based here. Leif Borge is from Aker Solutions.
Aker Solutions is very large in the North Sea region. We have around 23,000 people around the world, especially big in Norway, but also in Aberdeen in UK. We are meeting the first minister, Alex Salmond, and we will present our business, especially then in Aberdeen, and also our plans in order to develop that further. Well, Aker Solutions already have 2,700 employees in Aberdeen and have grown with around 350 over the last few months. What we are going to announce today are plans for growing with another around 500 employees over the next couple of years. Aberdeen is a hub both for the North Sea region, but also within certain technologies globally. So we are investing based on the competence that we have and that we believe are able to get in the market. It's mainly in different types of engineering, but also people working on installation in the fields in the North Sea.
The new Aberdeen City Council's administration is making the Northeast's booming energy industry a top priority. The local authority's new leader, Barney Crockett, says the townhouse must have a focus on business.
We have a close range of priorities. A lot of it will be about forward in the city, its economy, and making sure that economy is working very hard for everybody right across the city. I think the people of Aberdeen will see a difference. You know, we're extremely businesslike. We've got capability across all the main roles. I hope that the people of Aberdeen will be rallying around that message.
On Thursday, the Scottish Government unveiled a £10 million funding package for a planned oil platform decommissioning facility in Shetland. It's hoped the new deepwater quay at Dalesfoe will create around 150 jobs in Shetland and Aberdeen. And hard-pressed families feeling the squeeze of soaring energy bills were encouraged to shop around on Friday. A study by price comparison website Uswitch has found since 2004, the cost of power has risen 7 times faster than household income. The consumer watchdog's encouraging people to improve their home's insulation. Anne Robinson from Uswitch says the hike in costs is causing a major headache.
Energy bills are far outstripped our household income. They've gone up by 140% compared with household income at 20%. This is why 90% of us put our energy bills right at the very top of our major financial worries.
And that's the Energy Week podcast. I'm Rebecca Kern.
The North Sound Energy Week with Stork Technical Services, a leading energy support partner where safety and people always come first.